This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Want to become the sort of developer top rail shops like Thoughtbot fight over? Join Upcase today to get the pro training, insider knowledge, access to Thoughtbot developers, and a community of like-minded learners you need. Hone core skills like Vim, Tmux, Git, and Rails by visiting upcase.com/halfoff to get 50% off your first month of Upcase. Let's get that junior out of your title and start leveling up today with Upcase.
Giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hey everybody, you're listening to episode 170 of the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. I'm Chad Pytel, and with me today are two folks who've just co-authored a book about design sprints, C. Todd Lombardo from the Inoloff at Constant Contact and Trace Wax from Thoughtbot. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thanks.
So you just published a book about design sprints, like I just said, and we talked about design sprints on this podcast way back in July of 2014, episode 106, which if you want to go back and take a listen to that, you're more than welcome to. But I don't want to take for granted that everybody knows who's listening knows what a design sprint even is. So C. Todd, why don't you give us the elevator pitch description of what actually a design sprint is?
Sure. A design sprint is a time-boxed, typically a five-day session, or five individual days, where you go through, complete a full design cycle, running through a series of exercises that get you to take your idea, expand on it, unpack it, understand what the problem is, come up with some ideas, converge back down and bring those ideas to life in a short small prototype, and test those ideas with the actual people who would use this product.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good way to get some validation on a direction you want a product to go in a short period of time.
Yeah. And do you do it for just an individual piece of a product or a whole product?
So here in the Inoloft, we've done it, actually a combination of both. So It's been, sometimes we've had situations where it's, hey, we need to think about social media in this way, and we already have some social elements to our product, so let's run through a design sprint to see if we can flesh that out a little further. So it might be a component of a larger product. Mm-hmm. I've also done them for, hey, we want to kick off an entire new product direction or product area. That could be, I've done those with the enterprise folks up at Constant Contact or with our startup teams here in the Innovation Loft. Sometimes with the startup teams, they tend to be more whole product focused, whereas the stuff at Constant Contact oftentimes is more about parts of products.
Cool. So Trace, we have at Thoughtbot been doing product design sprints for a couple years now, right? And we've done, I would say, over 100 individual product design sprints. We lose count now. So you've been doing product design sprints for a while. And what's your favorite thing about the design sprint as opposed to a traditional way of what we might have done in the past?
What I love about a design sprint and the way that we're often able to work in general is that so many features that you might choose to build and get really excited about don't resonate with users and the real jobs that they're trying to be accomplished. And so when you're able to go back to first principles and really observe them in the situation of what they need done and to conceive of the ideas that are going to have the greatest impact and to be flexible by using the right type of design exercises to get to that, it's really exciting to see you potentially end up someplace that you might not have even thought that you might have started. So my favorite part is where you actually invalidate some of your idea. There was a design sprint that we did early on where we were able to eliminate 2/3 of the scope of the project and really focus into what mattered most by realizing 2/3 of what we were excited about didn't matter to our users.
Right. Or at least not for the first version, right?
Yeah. And even in that particular case, it was we were working on something for commercial buildings, and we went in thinking that they were all going to be like each other and they'd want to resemble each other. And we realized after speaking with them that that was never going to happen. Mm-hmm. But by comparing them to themselves, we were able to get a lot of efficiencies, and that was really exciting.
So in the book, you talk about CTOT, I think it was you, had experience in the Innoloft with a company called Phase One, which had a big invalidation as well.
Yeah, that was really interesting. They realized it wasn't really till after the design sprint that they realized they were essentially building the wrong product. Mm-hmm. They were going to market with a software as a service product that pulled together a lot of different data, mostly real estate data, that would be served up to a set marketing teams for solar companies and HVAC companies. And so these solar and HVAC companies could take this data and determine where they would want to push their marketing efforts and marketing dollars. So it allowed those teams to better spend their marketing efforts. So during that, they thought it would be a monthly SaaS business or maybe an annual SaaS business kind of product revenue for them. However, the design sprint proved that while they were right in the direction of, yes, the marketers at these types of companies wanted that data and information, they didn't want it in a SaaS product. What they wanted it was ultimately in a one-time report that might have been annually, like, hey, give me the report about this area, you know, this geographic area for the next or for the past 3 months or 6 months, and that's all I want to pay for. So it was much more of a they turned their business within a couple of weeks to being more of a market reporting market, serving up this data in reports rather than a software product where somebody could navigate around. So it was a little bit more customized for the end user, and they ultimately realized a huge revenue increase of about six or seven or eight fold in a matter of 6 weeks later. So it was really impressive to see the power of a design sprint happen right before my eyes. Right. I mean, within 2 months after the design sprint, they had blown away their revenue goals.
So this is important because it not only affected a huge change in the success of the company in terms of revenue, but they were on a path where they were going to spend significant development and design resources building a product.
Correct.
And they no longer needed to build that same product. They no longer needed to go and spend months or even longer developing something that ultimately no one would use or pay mm-hmm. for. And that's why we hit upon product design sprints and started doing them so aggressively at Thoughtbot, because we've always strived to find the smallest possible thing we could build or eliminate the things we didn't need to build. And the design sprint is a mechanism for hitting upon that quickly. And or validating that we are on the right path by talking to actual customers. And that's really valuable as well. Another thing that you talk about that I've seen really valuable, and Trace touched upon it as well, is consensus building. So we often are dealing with multiple founders or stakeholders who, while they've agreed in principle, they think they've all agreed to what it is they're actually doing. The design sprint is a great mechanism for actually getting that all out in a consensus building kind of way, where everyone arrives at the same conclusions as a group and moves forward as a group. Trace, do you have a good example of when we've seen that happen in the past?
Yeah, we did a design sprint for a nonprofit. And this was for a nonprofit called Character Lab that was teaching character traits like grit and optimism and zeal to K through 12 students. And it was a large design sprint. They had many stakeholders. Mm-hmm. They had the owners of the business, the people that were running the project, the design and technical team they had hired, and the people from the business itself were very passionate about what they were doing. And so the good news about the way that the design sprint process works is it democratizes getting these ideas out without a group think. There are a lot of individual exercises with a lot of sketching. Things are put on the wall. You might not even know who created which ideas. And by using some stickers and some dot voting, the best ideas fall out almost as a heat map of the most interesting ideas. And then when you do converging exercises to break into teams and to be, as we talk about in the book a bit, by being kind on people but tough on ideas, the best ideas can rise to the top and build a lot of consensus quickly.
And if I could add to that, one of the things I think is the thing that's going on here, it's been studied a bit academically by some folks at Harvard, Mike Norton. He talks about it in a paper called The IKEA Effect. And one of the reasons why people love their IKEA furniture is because they spent some hard labor or micro labor putting it together. And when everybody puts the output of a design sprint together, as they go through this process together, they become more aligned, become more invested in what work they're doing because they're making those decisions together.
And every design sprint may have different exercises, but I find it refreshing or even difficult sometimes. One of the exercises is to just draw out as many ideas as possible, and then you just discard them. It's an individual exercise. It's crazy eights, or there's a couple other ways to do it, but and where you're just drawing sketches over and over and over again, getting all of your ideas out on paper, and then you discard them. You don't show them to anybody. You don't discuss them. It's all just a process of getting the juices flowing, getting your ideas out. But another part of that is your idea was out. You got it out. And it doesn't need to be discussed. It will come out later in the process, or you'll have explored it and invalidated it on your own, those kinds of things. And I find just even that process of, it's not busy work. Busy work is the wrong word. It's very useful, but you don't need to discuss it. Everyone's getting what they want out of the process by being able to sketch their ideas down, even if ultimately they're discarded.
I think there's a thing around quantity begets quality. Mm-hmm. In design school, some of the exercises that I've did, like you'd have to develop 100 concepts on something, and you just think, oh my God, how am I going to develop 100? But the fact that you have to just keep going and keep going, keep going, some of the things you did on concept 2 or 3 end up showing up in concept 98 or 99, and that's totally okay, even though they do look slightly different. I think it's that quantity of generation that happens. The funny thing about you mentioned about people, you know, you don't have to discuss it or you feel like there might be something lost. One of the aspects of a design sprint I did last week, a couple of the participants said, well, hey, we didn't discuss all the different things we call them six. I gave the 6 ups or 8 ups. So I gave them 6 ups, just to give them a little less pressure and having to force them to do 8. And they were, well, we didn't talk about all of them. Why are we missing some ideas? I said, don't worry. Those will come out. The important ones will come out in the final sketches and wireframes once we get there. Though they're in the ether, they're on the walls. We'll actually, even if we may not have selected this particular one and moved it forward, it will still come forward if it's important.
Yeah.
There's something about sketching, too, that engages the creative part of your brain that gets the ideas flowing when you already have done the background and the investigation and developed empathy for the users and you have so much in your head. And then you put all of that aside and just you and a blank piece of paper and a pen just sketching as quickly as many ideas as possible. It's almost like being in figure drawing class. There's just a way that the ideas just flow naturally from that, where when we were writing out story cards in previous jobs and previous kickoff type of meetings, the ideas just didn't flow quite as quickly or as freely when you were doing things with writing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lot of people I talk to about design sprints, you know, we haven't gone through the specific 5 phases and, you know, what they are and everything. And maybe we should do that. But a lot of people, when we start talking about it and go through that, it's like, wow, it seems like this huge, complicated thing. And I have to continually remind people, actually, this is just 1 week that we're talking about. It's not this 3-month-long discovery process that might contain all of these things. It's a hyper-accelerated, fairly lightweight process. And I need to continually remind people who haven't done it before that that's what it actually is. And some sprints don't even need to last 5 days, right? You can condense it to just a few hours in some cases, right?
We had a sprint that we did where the client had this amazing opportunity to sell to a brand name client that would make or break his business. Mm-hmm. And he was about to leave for a trip. He was going to be out of the country and just wouldn't be available for days. But it was really important to get things kicked off. And we had 3 hours. And we had to figure out, and we talked about this in the book a bit, like what were the most essential parts of the process, given that we only had 3 hours to try to converge and figure out what we needed to do and get the most initial validation. And we were able to do it and create a prototype that then was validated by the business. It was really exciting.
So how did you guys get to the process of doing the book? How did that come about?
That's a good question. I think this started with Richard and I, our other co-author, Richard Banfield. We were on a bike ride discussing how we were just doing things at our organizations. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about what he called deep dives at Fresh Tilled Soil, which are essentially their versions of design sprints. Mm-hmm. We learned that there's a number of different nomenclatures for it. Just even last week, I gave a talk to the Design Museum Boston folks, and there was somebody in the audience who came up to me afterwards and said, "Oh yeah, we call them design SWATs, SWAT." So I've heard so many different names about them. So we were on a bike ride chatting about this, and I said, "Well, yeah, you know, aside from a handful of blog posts we've seen on the internet, there's no real formal resource about it. What if we just wrote a book about it?" And Richard said, "That sounds like a great." Instead of saying, "See, Todd, you're nuts. What are you thinking?" He said, "That's a great idea. Let's do it." So we went off and tried to mimic the design sprint process in our initial writing process and saying, "Okay, let's plan out." So we planned out 4 days at MC's house, and MC actually designed the book. He's the guy who did all the cover work and all the stuff you see inside the book.
Yeah, and for those who want to check out the book is pretty. It's not a normal book. It's more like. Well, it's wide format, I guess, is the way to put it. There's lots of pictures, diagrams, drawings, and it's laid out really nicely.
Yeah, yeah, MC did a great job. And we wrote it in a way to be very recipe-like. So we give you the 5-course, you know, dinner and every little recipe in it. But if you just want to make the mashed potatoes from course 3, you can just do that. And we wanted to have the photos there as well, like sort of very recipe-like. But anyway, so we did this sort of 4-day writing sprint where we started off, well, who is the user? What's their problems? What might they be looking for? What are the things that we like in business books? What are things we don't like in business books? How might this stand out? And then we did a table of contents and just wrote away for a few days, handed off a Google document to MC on Friday afternoon. And 2 hours later, he shows up and says, "Well, hey, what do you think of this? I just put this up in InDesign and our jaws hit the floor." And then I think the next week I was at Lean Enterprise in New York City, and Trace and I think chatted for like, I don't know, it felt like 8 hours, but we just chatted for the next like 4 or 5 hours all about design sprints. And then I said, "Trace, you need to be part of this and write this with us," because he just brought a level of depth, expertise, perspective that I felt like was missing from the existing text we had. And I mean, I think if you look at where we were and where we are now, you'd see that the evolution of the book to what it's become is really solid. And a lot of that's thanks to Trace being here too.
No, thanks a lot. And it was great to bring a developer's perspective to the work as well. I mean, part of a design sprint is determining what's easy and what's hard and what's going to give you the most value for the right amount of effort. So I was really glad to bring that perspective and to get to work with two such amazing designers as you and Richard.
Thank you. So we should probably talk a little bit about what is a design sprint and at least cover.
Yeah.
What is those 5 phases? We gave the elevator pitch, but we really dive deep into it. So maybe we should let everyone know, like, hey, here's what we've come up with.
Yeah, that would be great.
Sure. Well, a design sprint is a 5-phase, typically 5-day process designed to maximize the chances of building something that people want by first doing a dive into the background, really understanding what's come before, what things might be in other industries, but really be useful for what you're trying to do, to develop empathy for the users by looking at all the research that's been done on them, seeing how they've used similar projects, making sure that you're able to speak with a couple of them and keep those humans in mind as you're doing the design, and to really understand, you know, what their journey is today, where are their greatest pains, where are their opportunities, and to assemble that into things like a challenge statement, a table of assumptions, a user journey map of their journey today. And then on the second day, to...
Well, let's stick on understand a little bit. So we call that day understand, or that phase understand.
That's right.
And from our perspective at ThoughtBot, a lot of the customers are also coming to us with something done, whether it's just a concept or sketches or the thing. So for us, understand has a double meaning. Like, we're doing all of that background research together as a team, but it's also an opportunity for us to understand the client and the assumptions that they're making and the work that they've already done to understand their team and their dynamics and what they hope to accomplish and what their goals are. So there's a lot of stuff that we seek to understand in that first phase. And we've actually started to expand that with a pre-research phase as well for specific industries where we just don't know enough about the industry or that kind of thing. It is helpful to have a little bit of upfront time, especially if we want to speak to users. It can take a little bit of time to organize them and not be able to talk to everybody in one day. So,
yeah, when we first started doing them here at Constant Contact 3 years ago, we would actually expand understand to over 2 days, and we would put diverge and converge in the third day, partly because that practice of really unpacking the problem, and we would even go out of the building on Monday afternoon or get on the phone and get the team to either meet with or speak directly with the end users. And sometimes we wouldn't necessarily learn anything than we already knew. But one of the things I found was that it just hits that empathy reset button, and you can have that context to go talk to work with on the rest of the week. So, remember that conversation with Dana at that restaurant? And we could, that would be really helpful for the rest of the week. In that. But yeah, we've done the same thing as well in terms of expanding sometimes a pre, like, hey, what is all the research we have? So we'll go to our business analytics team and say, give us all the research you've got around this area, and these are the top few questions we want to bring into the room on Monday.
So logistically, for a design sprint, we get everybody in the same room. That's one thing that we do. And then there's a facilitator. And we try to have a facilitator as well as someone who's responsible for taking notes. Do you do something similar?
Very similar. Although our facilitator is often the person who's capturing a lot of things. We try to make a pretty dedicated effort to create little artifacts. So we use tons of post-it notes and tons of paper and lots of different size post-it notes. So that most things are done in an analog fashion. That also helps keep the laptops closed and iPhones off the table, so that people are either engaging with each other or engaging with the Sharpie and the Post-it, so that we have these snapshots throughout the week, and we just take a lot of photos of everything. So our facilitator typically is our recorder in most cases.
Yeah, and so Trace, you mentioned assumptions, that we're trying to identify assumptions. Can you elaborate a little bit on what we mean when we say assumptions?
Well, for any effort, there are the things that you know and the things that you think you know, but you're not sure, and the things that you don't know. And the assumptions are the things that you think you know, but you're not sure, and
you need to find out. Wrong. You know, sometimes we identify, okay, you're making that assumption. What proof do we have of that? And part of the sprint may be to seek the proof out.
Yeah, and there's so many things that you think are facts, and they're really assumptions. And so when we review the assumptions, we like to determine how might we test that assumption and how might that assumption be validated. And so when we write down the assumptions, we write that down as well and start planning our test even before we've begun the work on the prototype.
Okay, so next phase...
Diverge.
Right.
This is a fun phase because it's all about just generating ideas. And I mentioned earlier about, you know, coming up with 100 concepts in design school. It's a similar kind of thing. And I think we talked a little bit of six ups and eight ups, or crazy eights, they're often called. are a great tool for that day to just continually generate on the ideas. So once you've understood and unpacked and said, okay, we get a good sense of who we're solving the problem for, who what the problem is, who we're solving that problem for, and the context of that situation, then we'll try to generate ideas. And that's the overarching theme for that. I often kick them off with job stories. It's that combination of the job to be done framework that Clay Christensen has and the user story element, which often works very well with Agile. That mashup, I think, that Alan Clement put together is a great tool. And so we'll sort of look at the journey map and say, okay, what are the job stories based on this journey map? And we come up with a whole bunch of those. From there, I'll assign job stories to sub-teams. And I say, okay, you guys work on this job story and create. We'll go do a couple rounds of 6 ups or 8 ups on that job story and have another team do that. And then we're sort of mashing them all up by the end of the day, saying, okay, here's what we've done. Right. And we have just probably hundreds of ideas by the end of the day. To solve
6 ups
problem.
And 8 ups are where you just fold the paper into 6 panels or 8 panels. And so you're just drawing very small, lightweight sketches, you know, 6 at a time, 8 at a time with a time limit.
Yeah.
For those who haven't
done
it. Yeah,
sometimes I do the 6 ups with teams that are might be a little timid. Mm-hmm. If I say 8 ideas in 5 minutes, they sometimes freak out and say, okay, well, let's do 6. And they relax a little bit and say, all right. It's kind of interesting. I've tried not to push them too hard because then you get the deer in the headlights where they just don't write anything down. Mm-hmm. So you got to figure out the right balance, what works for the team. But more advanced teams that I know have done this a number of times, I can say, no, we're doing 8 ups. You guys can do this.
Okay. So then after Diverge.
So the next step is to converge. And this is where you take that large range of ideas that you've diverged on. You start to make some decisions. You can look at the range of ideas and look at some of the conflicts between them when there are conflicting approaches. And the differences between those ideas can be very interesting and trigger other ideas. And these are some of the things that you need to resolve that can make some good good discussions.
I want to clarify, what are you trying to converge upon? Are you trying to converge upon what the full product is going to be or what the prototype is going to be?
Well, what you want to converge upon is really what your riskiest assumptions are that you want to test. And what sort of artifact is going to be the minimal useful artifact to validate or invalidate those assumptions?
Right.
And so as such, you're really just looking at, you know, what's going to be built in a day, let alone, you know, what's to come. Right. And the ideas that you're creating can really inform what might come later. The validation or invalidation that you get can really help inform what it might take to do the rest of the project. And is it a small project or is it a big project? And really help with your planning, really help with the team coming together. But the artifact that you want at the end of the Converge day is a set of wireframes that will map out what you want to prototype, as well as a test plan for how you're going to use that to validate or invalidate your assumptions.
So I have a pretty decent example of something in a recent sprint that we did where we expected that the primary users would be business people. And so we wanted to determine whether those people would use LinkedIn and connect with LinkedIn primarily. And so that came up in, you know, assumptions. And we decided you make decisions for the prototype to specifically invalidate or validate that assumption. So, for example, we ended up saying this is a big enough assumption. We need to know whether people will do it or not. Let's prioritize that the prototype will have, you know, email login and LinkedIn login and see what people use. And then when we tested the prototype, nobody clicked LinkedIn. That's great because we didn't build LinkedIn. It was just to see whether people would use it because it's just a clickable prototype. And so now we know for that product that we don't need to build LinkedIn. And we asked them, why did you not use LinkedIn? And people try to separate. It was a primarily social application, even though they were business people. And so they answered, you know, I want to keep those things separate, my personal social life and my business life, which is totally reasonable. And we were able to validate that, or I guess in this case, invalidate that.
Yeah, we often call what we build on the build day is a minimum MVCs, minimum viable concept. Now, I know some of the developers who might listen to this might chuckle because that's model view controller.
Yeah.
We do that partly because it's been a nomenclature that tends to work well and describe it well enough so that people don't think we're coming out of the week with an actual prototype product that could be launched into production.
Right.
Now, maybe in very rare cases that might be true, but oftentimes we want to make sure conceptually we're going in the right direction from the design direction and the features and product, and does it solve this need in a way that makes people's eyes, you know, the pupils dilate and they go, yeah, they're really excited
right.
about that. I can do this. Oh, I didn't know. That's great. So that kind of thing we has been really helpful for us.
And when you're working on, when you're doing a sprint for a subset of features, it may even go further. I've seen it go where you're prototyping something with the sole purpose of validating or invalidating one behavior. And, you know, it's not at all what you're going to build, but you want to validate that behavior. So you want to determine whether a specific kind of user will behave in a certain way when put in a certain situation. So you build a prototype specifically for that to test that. We had that when we wanted to identify whether people who were sports nuts would enter in a lot of statistical data if we asked them to do it. So we just had a prototype that was all that it was, and it was a prototype that was devised where it was a almost never-ending, a very long series of steps where you enter in a little bit of data, and when you do that, then we ask for more. And when you do that, we ask for even more. And what we found was that the people who get to like step two or three will go through like all 10 steps of entering data. So if you bailed, then you were the kind of person who wouldn't do it. But we found that almost everyone who went to step three would then go through the rest of the steps of increasingly having to enter more and more data.
I think sometimes doing design sprints and doing this type of work, like you just become like sociologists and anthropologists mm-hmm. and studying human behavior. It's fascinating. It's one of the things that I love about it.
So we've talked about prototyping. That comes after the converging. And so once we have the prototype, that brings us to the final phase, right?
Yeah. So this is where the rubber hits the road. And this is where you can see if all the work you've done, if those assumptions that you've called out are right or wrong. And I often stack rank the assumptions, do a sorting exercise to make sure we have the most critical assumptions identified at the top of the list. And we look for between 5 and 10 users to try and test with. That preferably in person is the ideal, but that isn't always feasible. So sometimes we do a lot of webinars. Sort of go-to meeting is our tool of choice, and we'll just record the webinar so people aren't in the room can see it. But we do like to have the whole team there to watch. One of the things that I've learned about the test day is if there's anybody in the organization, in an enterprise, sometimes the people look at this and be like, what do I want to do this for? That might be skeptical about, is this time worth it? Is this a good investment of, let's say, you know, 8 people's time for 5 days? That can actually be a very expensive proposition depending on what organization you're at. This is when their eyes can go, oh, that's mm-hmm. why. Yeah, I'm really glad we did this. That's when they get converted to the other side, so to speak. That's when they come to the dark side and see the value of this. We only spent a week, but we learned that we were wrong, or we learned that this was actually the right thing, what usually happens is you're right about a couple of things and you're wrong about a couple of things. And they're usually roughly equally important. Like, oh, we were totally right about this thing, but man, nobody clicked this button like you had the LinkedIn button mm-hmm. gave example of. We had this one thing with contextual help that we were trying out a couple months ago. And while somebody was crafting their email subject line, I think, you know, could some contextual help pop up to give them some coaching on how to craft a better subject line in terms of doing some analysis of the text? People just ignored it completely. Mm-hmm. They just didn't even pay attention to it. And we dug into understanding why, as a lot of people thought they were like advertisements because they were showing the design choices we made. They showed up on the side, almost like a sidebar. And so people weren't looking at it and thinking that it was coaching from the product. They were looking at it as, oh, this, you're trying to sell me something else. So things like that are what you can learn during test day, which is kind of fun and awesome. And then you do the retrospective and you can see, okay, what do we learn? I usually do I'll get a couple of green and red markers and, okay, assumption, check, or or red X, you know, what are we, yes or no? Or do I put a big question mark next to it? And we just go down each assumption during the retrospective and see how close were we, how off were we, and then what's the next steps.
And actually, from those next steps for Thoughtbot, Trace, what are a lot of those next steps for the sprints we do?
So after a design sprint, it positions you really well to start the project. And many design sprints have a lot of validation. There are things that you know that you need to do. And moreover, you know how important they are, and you're able to prioritize a lot better by understanding that importance to the users. So you can rally the team together and create a backlog of these jobs to be done stories. And for the things that you got the validation on, you're really ready to proceed. And that gives the developers something to work on as they're starting the project. And meanwhile, the designers involved can look at the things that were invalidated. And if those are still really important jobs to be done, but they just weren't being done right, we can do some design challenges or iterations. Sital, I think you call them jump starts.
Yes.
Where you can do a mini design sprint iteration, and you can just prototype some isolated things for particular assumptions and then get back with users that next initial week of the project to validate or invalidate those. So as you start to come into, for example, the third week of a project, you're feeling like you have a decent map to proceed on where you can meet with users every week and keep designing and building an integrated iteration until you get to the point, you know, perhaps a couple months into the project where you're looking at a next set of features, jobs to be done and assumptions, and you can repeat the process with another design sprint.
Yeah.
Yeah, that jump sprint is really powerful for us. It's often works when you have there's still questions.
Yeah.
Like we've learned some things and there's still questions. So we do a couple of those, and it's kind of like the lean startup build, measure, learn, wash mm-hmm. cycle. Mm-hmm. And we've just, again, nomenclature sometimes is everything. It helps spread the word around here internally, and it seems to have resonated well with people. So call them what you like, but that seems to be how we phrase it here.
Awesome. Well, I think the book is a valuable tool for people who are doing design sprints or who want to start doing them. Don't be intimidated. They're more lightweight than you think. What's the best way for people to get the book right now?
I think O'Reilly.com, you can find it there. Mm-hmm. I think you can find it on Amazon too. I think either place, whatever works for you. It's both in hardcover and in digital.
Yeah.
And digital can come in a variety of formats. It's a soft cover. Right. We actually wanted it to be a little bit different, like something that's left on a table in a workroom that people could flip through and earmark it and oh yeah, this is the exercise I need to come back and just read up on the recipe for, or I can flip open and see, yeah, this is the page. Actually, when we were doing the interviews last week, two guys were in the design sprint that hadn't been in one before. I opened up the page. They were working on structuring the interview. So I just opened the page up. I said, put a little marker, and I said, here, mm-hmm. you guys read this and work on this while me and the designer go finish the rest of the prototype. And that's kind of how our Thursday was. It's kind of nice to have that artifact there.
Yeah, that's awesome. So we'll link up the book in the show notes, which you can find at giantrobots.fm/170, which is the episode number of this episode. And actually, we have a design podcast as well called Tentative. And episode 6 of that, Kyle and Retta, the hosts, talked in detail about the tools they use for prototyping in the design sprints. So if you found this conversation interesting, you probably definitely want to check out that episode. That's at tentative.fm/6, and we'll link that in the show notes as well. What's the best way if people want to get in touch with you, C. Todd? What's the best way they can do that?
Probably the easiest way is on Twitter. I am C. Todd, IAMCTODD. Or you can email me, hi@ctodd.com. Those are the pretty quickest and easiest ways to find me. So I'm happy to chat about them. We also use the hashtag design sprint. Usually Richard and I are Twitterholics, so we're usually monitoring things like that. So if I see something come across, I'll certainly post something interesting to that hashtag as well.
And Trace, what about you?
So I'm Trace D. Wax on Twitter. D is in David. And you can also email me at trace@thoughtbot.com.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chad. It's been an honor to be here.
Thank you for the chat. It's always a pleasure.
Show notes for this episode can be found at giantrobots.fm/170. This episode was recorded and produced by Tom Obarski, and I'm Chad Pytel. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.